Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today is the first Tuesday in November, which is typically the fall election day in this country. A year ago, Donald Trump was elected president, and a year from today, people will go to the polls in Wisconsin to vote in the gubernatorial, congressional, Senate, and state legislative races.
29 years ago, this was the day that the Reagan era started to reach its end as George H.W. Bush was elected president. The 4 years Bush was in office were themselves an end of an era. It was in that eventful term that the Cold War essentially came to its conclusion with the fall of the Berlin Wall, and the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Presidential scholar Jeffrey Engel examines the end of the Cold War through the lens of the Bush White House in a new book called When the World Seemed New. And we reached Engel at his office in Texas. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good to talk to you.
So I want to start this in a strange place. I mean, I had a chance to speak with John Meacham when his biography of George H.W. Bush came out a year ago. And I remember talking with him about the idea that the years George H.W. Bush was in office may have been the most eventful 4 years of a single term in history, or certainly among them. Is that a conclusion you would draw as well?
Oh, most definitely. In fact, I'd go a little bit further to say that George Bush's 4 years in office presented as complex and as numerous and as difficult a series of challenges on the international stage as arguably faced by any president in American history over the course of their entire administration. I think the only rival, in fact, is really Franklin Roosevelt. And, of course, he was in office 3 times as long. So it really is remarkable how many things occurred at the same time that would have normally it captured the attention of an entire administration's 4 years, but instead they just happened like dominoes in this one.
You write in a number of places that George H.W. Bush was arguably the most qualified person ever to be elected president. Can you talk about his life experience before the vice presidency, certainly, that most contributed to his ability to manage this unprecedented time in world history?
Yeah, well, he was, in fact, I think, the person with the best resume before becoming president that's ever held the office. If nothing else, he's certainly within the top two or three. He was, at different times in his career, obviously he was a businessman, and then a very successful one, actually. And then he was a congressperson from Texas, and then he was U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, then head of the Republican National Committee, then de facto U.S. ambassador to China. He was essentially the ambassador, but we didn't formally have diplomatic relations at that time. And then, of course, he was head of the Central Intelligence Agency. So it really is a remarkable series of achievements and accomplishments and goals, which all, for the most part, wind up focusing in the international realm. And when he became president, that was really the place that everybody understood his particular expertise was as a diplomat, as an international actor. When he was vice president, he did a lot of work both in front of the camera and also behind the scenes for the Reagan administration, essentially smoothing out things internationally with a whole cadre of leaders around the world who he either already knew or who would know when he was president. So it really was a remarkable experience he was able to draw on.
So really, the word I used in that previous question, manage, is really an appropriate one in this case. He seems to have had a really distinct managerial leadership style.
He really did. One of the things that we're discovering now that the archives are really open for this period, frankly, is just how dangerous and tumultuous the entire period was. I mean, the end of the Cold War can be understood in many ways as the collapse of the Soviet Empire. And we know going back through history that there are basically no examples of a major empire collapsing without an ensuing great power war. And certainly no other examples involving nuclear weapons in the mix. So one of the things that Bush was able to do was to draw upon that international experience and all those international contacts in order to essentially, while craziness and chaos was breaking out around the world, to pick up the phone and to call foreign leaders and to have private, long, deep conversations, sometimes well into the night, sometimes for several hours, essentially calming international tensions, working out international agreements ahead of time, keeping essentially the machinery of the international system going at a time when it could very well have seized up.
Right. One of the key areas, there are really two events in this period in particular that maybe people are only appreciating with the passage of time, and I wanted to talk with you about both of them. There is much made these days about the sort of quietness with which, maybe there's not much made, maybe it's just because I've read your book, there's much made, the quietness with which President Bush responded to the fall of the Berlin Wall, that is his reluctance to dance on it, if you will. Why was that such an important aspect of his response?
This is really a remarkable story because it tells us a lot about him and also about the times. So to set the stage here, the fall of the Berlin Wall happens in November of 1989, which is about 4 years into Mikhail Gorbachev's experiment of reforming the Soviet Union, really changing the Soviet Union in what can only be described as a revolution. Now, needless to say, Gorbachev as a revolutionary had a lot of enemies. He had a lot of enemies within his own government. In fact, we would see only about a year and a half later, they would come to launch a coup against him, essentially conservative communists, if you will, who didn't like the democratic direction he was taking the country. And Bush was keenly aware that Gorbachev was essentially on shaky political ground the entire time he was in office, and also that Gorbachev's enemies had a lot of allies, if you will, around the Eastern Bloc. So when the Berlin Wall fell, when Eastern Germany seemed to be on the verge of collapse, when the empire of Soviets seemed to be on the verge of collapse, Bush consciously said, I'm going to not say anything. Essentially, others around the country asked for him as the president to lead a victory parade or to give a victory speech. And he wisely said, you know, if I say anything dramatic, if I crow, if I beat our chest, that's going to add ammunition to the enemies of Gorbachev, who are already upset and thinking about a coup. So rather than essentially exacerbate tensions and make things more difficult for our allies, Gorbachev in particular, I'm just going to keep quiet. Keep quiet, even though critics are going to assail me and my poll numbers are going to drop. I know that the future of the world, frankly, is more important than my poll numbers.
I was just going to say, there was a political cost to him for doing this.
Dramatically. I mean, he was always a person we should remember who had come up through the Republican Party. He was a very establishment candidate. And as a consequence, you know, he had a reputation for being someone who did not speak his own mind in many ways. He was honestly referred to as a wimp on the presidential campaign trail. And therefore, when he didn't stand up at these moments, it seemed to reinforce the image that this was a man with no principles. This was a man with no backbone. His poll numbers dropped after Tiananmen Square when he acted quietly, after Berlin Wall when he acted quietly. Basically, his poll numbers only went up in foreign policy when he stood up and conducted the leadership of the Gulf War, essentially made a strong military stand in the Persian Gulf. Most other times, he was perfectly willing, not happy, but willing to accept political barbs and accept political consequences for what he believed was the necessity of quiet diplomacy.
The other landmark event I was hoping you would address, that you just referenced it, is the Tiananmen Square uprising, which was, first of all, an event that caught many in American politics by surprise. What was the balancing act he had to orchestrate when it came to China?
Well, one of the things that's really critical about Bush is not only did he know China, having been there and believed that he understood China, he also understood China's democratic movement in many ways as a natural progression from China's engagement with the world. He had been there in the early 70s when China was essentially just reengaging the world. He had known Deng Xiaoping when he was first setting up China's leader, who was just first setting up the economic reconstruction of the country, if you will. And consequently, Bush believed that the more China was engaged in the world, the more it would become naturally prosperous and critically democratic. And he saw the Tiananmen Square uprising in many ways as a validation of this idea that, look, China's been engaged in the world for over a decade now, and now its people are really clamoring for democracy. Therefore, of course, when that democracy movement was crushed brutally by Deng Xiaoping's regime in June of 1989, Bush essentially had one of two options. He could do what his critics suggested, which was isolate the Chinese, punish the Chinese, cut off all trade with the Chinese. And Bush chose the opposite course, which was to essentially sanction the Chinese, yes, but really to leave the door open for them to remain engaged in the international system, because he firmly believed that democracy that had flourished at Tiananmen would basically flourish again if only given the opportunity to have the sunlight and the fertilizer, if you will, of international contacts. And he really tried to take a long-term approach to where he thought China would go.
Right. He was looking at it from an incremental standpoint.
Yes, with a very long time frame. He recognized that having been in China, he recognized that the history of the Communist Party, you know, went back generations, and it had transformed dramatically over those generations. And consequently, he expected that, at the very least, after Tiananmen Square, when he tried to have quiet diplomacy and keep relations open, he still recognized and discussed with his advisors, it's going to be 5, 10, maybe 15 years before we're able to talk normally again with the Chinese. But we need to start now, so we can get to that place in 15 years.
It is interesting to read about that time and consider that time in the history of U.S.-China relations and consider what the current president, as we're having this conversation, is about to go to China and is taking a decidedly different approach.
Yeah, it's really hard to find two people whose actions in the White House are more different than George Bush, 41, and Donald Trump, where Bush was quiet, was confident, was really experienced. Donald Trump, I think it's fair to say, is none of those things. And we can really see that in the way that he's conducting not only his China diplomacy, I'm talking about Trump, but also his diplomacy in East Asia more broadly, which is done largely by tweet and by bluster, two things that George Bush, even if he had had the opportunity to tweet, I'm sure he would not have in office because he recognized the power and the effect of not only his own words, but of the mistaken word. He was always worried about saying the wrong thing inadvertently and having markets crash or having an international incident be occurred. The idea that he would send out his thoughts spontaneously without thinking about them just honestly never occurred to Bush.
That was partly what his diary was for, but even from reading pieces of his diary, those words are pretty considered as well.
Yeah, he spent a lot of time in his diary, and it's really a wonderful thing that we have a diary from the president. He may actually be the last president that we know of to leave a diary. It's too dangerous in many ways these days.
Yeah.
He really spent a lot of time thinking through issues, working through issues, and frankly, doing a fair amount of venting to his diary. So, he was willing to criticize his opponents and to question his allies in his diary, knowing that he didn't want to do that publicly because of the political consequences or the international consequences. So he could refer to his critics in his diary, for example, those who said that the United States should pull back internationally after the Cold War, as stupid peaceniks and as beatniks and as lots of 60s terms, actually, and as isolationists, something which he would never have done in public because that would have been the story, not the issue. He wanted to keep focused on the issue.
It's hard to consider the words peaceniks and beatniks without imagining his, political opponents wearing berets and smoking little cigarettes.
Exactly. Well, it really does tell us a lot about who Bush is. This was a very conservative man in the sense that he was a traditional business person. He was a traditional Republican, frankly, of the kind that doesn't exist anymore. He believed in free trade. He believed in international trade. He believed in internationalism. Believed in a strong civil rights regime, at least as far as the federal government is concerned. He believed, frankly, in immigration. He believed, essentially, I like to say, that both George H.W. Bush and, to a large extent, Ronald Reagan, too, essentially would have no place in today's Republican Party because they're just simply way too centrist for today's discussions.
One of the ways you were able to break new ground with this book was to get access to previously classified or sealed or little-known documents. What were the kinds of sources that you were able to tap into which had theretofore been out of sight?
Well, these were all documents largely in the Bush Presidential Library in College Station, Texas, and they were documents that we knew were there, but we were not allowed to have access to. Essentially, the way our declassification system works is that even after 25, 30 years, in order to get a document released, a national security document I'm referring to, something from the State Department or the CIA or the Defense Department, you essentially need to ask for it, and then it needs to be approved by that agency that you can have that document. Well, you can imagine, this can be a very long, arduous process. So We've been working on a massive declassification project at the Bush Library that's going into its 10th year now, essentially trying to ask for whatever we can get after we identify that there are documents that we want, and then honestly just crossing our fingers and hoping that we get them. And by applying for literally tens upon tens of thousands, we have been able to get a fair number out there. And what's really wonderful about that is that these are all then available to everyone in the general public and to future historians. Anybody with a driver's license can go look at those documents tomorrow if they wish.
If I read it correctly someplace, did I see that the number of FOIA requests you had for just those documents dwarfed the number of all the other FOIA requests at other presidential libraries in the country?
Yes, at other presidential libraries. And this is one of those great statistics and one of those great facts that one of the archivists in Washington told me at one point that our project has more documents under review and requested than all the other presidential libraries combined. And it's one of those statistics that you just decide not to verify. It sounds nice, but more importantly, the point that I think he was trying to make is that this really is the largest ongoing project of its time, at its time, in terms of getting as much as possible out of one particular resource.
What were the greatest surprises for you, things that you might have thought you knew about that period that you understand differently today?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, the greatest surprise to me is how dangerous the situation was. I think I really can't stress that enough, that there are numerous moments when we look back on the end of the Cold War, we generally think of it as a celebratory time, as a time of democracy flourishing, as communism collapsing, and really an optimistic time. We now know that there are any number of scenarios, any number of false moves that could have sent things spiraling out of control. So one of the things that was really amazing to me and that came to be impressed by over and over was how Bush and other leaders, but Bush especially, worked very hard to keep calm and to keep others calm, to keep the international system calm, while still recognizing something that's really, really important, which is that at the end of the day, the President of the United States or the Premier of the Soviet Union actually has less control when a crowd goes up to a police station, say in Leipzig or in Tiananmen Square, than the average soldier on the street. You know, one 17-year-old soldier who gets nervous and fires his weapon can start a cascading international incident no matter what the president says. So it really drove home to me the idea that when we have an international crisis, honestly, such as we are seeing today in many parts of the world, that the more a president can decrease tensions as a general proposition, the safer we all are. Because in a time of heightened tensions, frankly, even the people who think they're in charge don't really have a lot of control. The person in the crowd who can pick up a rock or the young recruit who can fire his gun because he's scared has actually more control in that moment to cause chaos than even the most powerful people in the world.
Well, Jeff Engel, it's really a fascinating read, and I thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Oh, it's wonderful to talk to folks from Wisconsin. I miss it up there.
Jeffrey Engel's new book is called When the World Seemed New, George H.W. Bush and the End of the Cold War. Engel did his graduate work at the University of Wisconsin, and today he's founding director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University in Texas.